Thanks for tuning in for the August 13th podcast. I'm Stacey Clardy, section editor of the Neurology Podcast. This week's featured interview showcases a longitudinal study of the severity of impulse control disorders in Parkinson's disease and REM sleep behavior disorder. In the What's Trending segment, you'll hear an interview on CRISPR babies and what is needed for the world to be ready for gene editing. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. You just find the Neurology Podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, all available online on the same webpage. It really is easy and it's free for AAN members.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell with the Neurology Podcast, and today I'm very excited to speak with Dr. Michelle Hu and Dr. David Akai. Michelle is a neurologist and David is a neuropsychiatrist, and they are both at the University of Oxford Hospital's NHS Trust. And today we're discussing their recent paper titled Impulse Control Disorders in Parkinson's and RBD, a Longitudinal Study of Severity. It was published in this week's issue of Neurology. Michelle, David, thank you both for taking a few minutes to join us today.
Thank you.
So for our listeners, you may recall that we covered a similar topic about a year ago in the July 17th, 2018 podcast on the incidence of impulse control disorders in Parkinson's disease. And obviously, these diseases, especially Parkinson's, are so common, and so there's really a lot of practical information for us to cover. And so start with the question for all the neurologists in our audience who are taking care of patients with neurological disease every day. What would you say is the take-home message from this paper?
So as a neurologist treating people with Parkinson's, the main message is that impulsive compulsive behaviors or impulsive compulsive disorders are very common in Parkinson's. And many of these don't go away. They don't remit. In fact, they can get worse from what is perhaps a mild subsyndromal phase to a more severe phase that has a big impact on the person and their family. So I think all patients and neurologists or gerontologists with Parkinson's interest need to be more aware of this as a potential side effect and to keep asking.
Before we talk about the details of your study, you've already mentioned one of the points that I thought was so interesting, which is we often treat impulse control disorder as this binary yes-no problem. But really, as you point out, these behaviors have a dimension to them and can present in a variety of ways. And so could you talk a little bit about the differences between impulse control behavior and impulse control disorder, and then also maybe share some examples of these types of behaviors?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And I think it's something that sometimes when people are dealing with psychiatry, they're a little unclear about. So in psychiatry, actually, it's quite a simple specialty. You can have any range of syndromic problems. Anything that might be on a spectrum that might be seen as different from the general population. But psychiatry only really cares when those, whatever those characteristics are, become problematic. And they usually define that in one of two ways. So either problematic to the level that it stops you working, either occupational, you know, or studying or that sort of type of thing, or it stops you with your having the relationships that you would otherwise be able to have and enjoy. So we define it usually as social or occupational impairment. And when something gets sufficiently bad that it affects either of those two functions, it's usually then put into what is still in some ways a categorical sort of view of problems that meet caseness for disorder. So then that's when the DSM, you know, sort of 5 and the ICD-10s come in, when actually something's impacting on a level that it can meet caseness for disorder. That usually means that people have then started looking at effective treatments for that condition as well, because if it's that severe a problem, people look to see how they can help with that as such. So that's where the term impulse control disorder comes from. The behaviors include the disorders, of course, but they're also the subsyndromal forms of presentation. You know, those where you, for instance, notice that you have a change in preference for sweet things, and so you might eat more candy, but actually it's not causing you a huge amount by way of problems. So impulse control behaviors include both disorders and the subsyndromal forms of the condition as a broad, larger category.
Do you have any other examples other than eating sweets? I thought one of the ones you pointed out in the paper was really interesting, which is for folks that go overboard with hobbies, folks for whom hobbyism is a problem, that you mentioned the idea of technology and kind of overuse of smartphones or on the internet.
Yes. I mean, that for me is one of the most fascinating aspects of all of this. The behaviors, impulse control behaviors, are felt to be reward-based behaviors as their essence. And that usually divides into a range of categories. So you can have the four main ones that people tend to know about, which is pathological gambling or compulsive buying as well, which are learnt rewarding behaviors, and the more natural behaviors, which are, you know, sort of compulsive eating or hypersexuality as well, which are natural based conditions. However, people have also noticed that there are a range of other problems that can occur with these conditions. And those are repetitive based behaviors that can be subcategorized into either simple behaviors such as punding, which is, you know, sort of sorting, ordering, arranging objects, you know, sort of taking things apart, that sort of type of thing, or the more complex forms of repetitive behaviors. And those are called hobbyism. And that can include things such as being out in the garden to 1 o'clock in the morning until your spouse calls you back in, or going off and playing golf all day, which might sound fun to start off with, but not if you're coming back at 2 a.m. and no one knows or has seen you all day, that sort of type of thing. Repetitive behaviors are, of course, shaped by your surroundings. And I don't know what they would have been like in the 1980s. Probably would have been something about sort of sorting out buttons, for instance. But now with modern day technology, people are using their smartphones more and more. And those are inherently rewarding anyway. And especially when you may have, for example, motor problems that mean that you getting out and about is more difficult. You may end up using your technology more and more, your phones more and more. And people can play games on those. They can do tasks such as gambling on them as well, that sort of type of thing. So it is about access, we think, which shapes these behaviors, which is quite fascinating.
And I think the other main take-home message from the paper is actually that, as you said, it changes our thinking of these disorders from a black and white yes or no to a much more multidimensional disorder, which has this subsyndromal variant.
So when you looked at these populations of patients, those with Parkinson's disease, how prevalent were impulse control behaviors? And did you find any clinical predictors for the symptoms?
So firstly, to say that the data was tested on 921 cases of Parkinson's, and they were examined at baseline and then longitudinally at 18 and 36 months. So what we found when we looked at these 921 cases of Parkinson's is actually that at baseline, between 21 to 25% screened positive for ICB using a questionnaire called the QIP, which stands for the Questionnaire for Impulsivity in Parkinson's. And when we looked at that longitudinally, the figure varied between 21 to 25% as a whole. For the clinician, the important part really is what were the features that were associated with ICD. And so Parkinson's ICD was associated with dopamine agonist use. So these would be things in UK such as pramipexole, ropinirole, both the once a day, the TDS use. Also the topical patch, the rotigotine, and the TDS, the three times a day versions of ropinirole, pramipexole, and of course apomorphine. Other drivers to predict ICD were the presence of motor complications. So by definition here, we're talking about the onset of involuntary movements that we call levodopa-induced dyskinesias or wearing off phenomenon. And interesting also, the presence of apathy. However, it was not driven by people with Parkinson's who also had RBD, the rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder that happened in, certainly on questionnaires, we see in around 40% of our patient group at diagnosis from their Parkinson's.
And just building on from what Michelle has mentioned, the implications from the clinical perspective are that it is important, especially when someone is on a dopamine agonist, to ask actively about these conditions. And that's in two ways. Firstly, prevention is the best means of treatment. So warning people that these conditions may occur before you start the tablet is important. But also, secondly, from the clinical perspective, if someone has lots of motor complications and they're on a dopamine agonist, you may even see this, you know, from someone just sitting in your neurology clinic waiting room, you know, that they have these dyskinesias, the wriggling, jerking, breathing movements, that actually your vigilance towards asking about impulse control disorders should be higher. What I would say is simply asking about it, do you have any repetitive reward-based activities, is insufficient. And what we know from this scale is your pickup rate, your threshold for pickup is far higher when you use active screening tools and ask about each of the conditions specifically.
My other observation, just as a Parkinson's neurologist, is that sometimes these conditions are so embarrassing for patients to discuss that even when you actually ask them in clinic specifically about things like hypersexuality, for example, and I've had this happen to me, they'll deny that. And then actually what has then happened is that the Parkinson nurse has actually been in the patient's home and the patient's wife has then very quietly taken her aside to say, actually, there is an issue. I didn't mention this at the last clinic visit to Doctor Who, but so-and-so has been doing X, Y, and Z.
I think this is really practical advice, both asking about the symptoms and also being aware that patients may not be forthcoming with them. The questionnaire that you all used, is that clinically available? If our listeners wanted to use that in clinic, are they able to access that?
The PICS scale is available. You simply just need to request it from myself, and I happily send it over.
Terrific. Any other clinical recommendations or things we did not cover that you wanted to talk about?
I guess just lastly to say that we found that the prevalence of OCD was only 1% in people with a prodromal form of Parkinson's. So these are 250 people with polysomnographically diagnosed rapid eye movement sleep behavior disorder, or RBD. And in that group, the prevalence of ICD was only 1%, so very similar to that of controls, which I think surprised me initially. But then when I started to think about it, of course, it does make sense, because the prodromal patients have very subtle motor dysfunction that's not yet bad enough to lead to a clinical diagnosis of Parkinson's. And of course, none of them are on any treatment with dopamine agonists or levodopa.
Terrific. Well, I encourage our audience to check out the paper. It's available now in this week's issue of Neurology. Once again, the title of the paper is Impulse Control Disorders in Parkinson's and RBD, a Longitudinal Study of Severity. Michelle and David, thank you both again for joining us. This is Jason Crowell with the Neurology Podcast, and today I'm very excited to be speaking with Dr. Heidi Ledford. She is a senior science reporter for Nature based in London. Heidi published a news feature in Nature on June 19th titled, CRISPR Babies, When Will the World Be Ready? I'll pause quickly here and share with our listeners that if you missed our previous podcast on CRISPR, I really encourage you to go back and listen. We did two segments on the December 18th, 2018 podcast, including an interview with bioethicist Josephine Johnston discussing the ethical implications of CRISPR and gene editing. We also did a two-part interview with Pam Bellick of the New York Times. She's been covering the story of He Jianque, the Chinese scientist who announced last year that he used CRISPR technology to edit the germline of twins who were born in the fall of 2018, and that two-part interview aired on April the 29th and May the 6th. Now, Heidi, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us today and talk about your recent paper.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that.
So I'm really glad that you wrote this piece, because in those previous podcasts that I just mentioned, we ultimately found ourselves asking, what is it going to take before this technology is used clinically? And this is what you addressed in your article. So before we dive into some of the details, in just two or three sentences, what would you say are the next steps for CRISPR technology?
Well, before it could be used for heritable gene editing, I tend to group the next steps into either technical issues, things like, are you sure that it's not making unwanted changes to the genome, or are you sure that the change that you wanted to make is actually safe? And then I have on the other side what I would consider to be actually bigger issues pertaining to ethics and social implications, legal issues, all these discussions that have to take place before society really feels that it's ready to accept something this dramatic.
I think that's a great dichotomy to think about this technology. So let's dive in, first of all, to the technical issues. Again, we've covered this technology many times before on our podcast, but in case we have some new listeners, could you first of all give us a brief overview of how CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing works? And then secondly, can you explain some of the ways it might go wrong?
Sure. So overall, gene editing is a technique that one hopes would make very precise changes to the genome. And CRISPR-Cas9 is a very popular way to do that at the moment. CRISPR-Cas9 basically hinges on an enzyme called Cas9 that will cut DNA at a site of your choosing. So you can feed the system an RNA molecule that will direct the enzyme to a specific, you hope specific, point in the genome. It'll make a cut there. And that's pretty much all that it does. And then at that point, you rely on the cell's repair mechanisms to repair the damage that you've just done to the DNA. And that repair can generate a number of different changes at a given site. So one of the most common changes you might get is a deletion where the cut was made. So it stitches the DNA back together, but now it's left out, you know, maybe one base pair, maybe three base pairs, maybe something bigger. You might get a small insertion where now you've stuck in another letter into the sequence. There's also a way to feed the system a DNA template, and then you kind of hope, I guess, that the DNA repair process will use that template when it's fixing the DNA, and you can use that to actually insert a whole new sequence into that site. But the truth of the matter is that in a lot of cell types, that kind of repair doesn't happen very often. So what you can end up with is really, if you have a population of cells and you've tried to edit them at a specific site, you can end up with a bunch of different changes at that site within that population of cells. Another issue is that you can end up with a number of different changes within that population. And then another sort of complication on top of all of this is that we don't know a lot about DNA repair in human embryos. It's difficult to study human embryos for very good and obvious reasons, but we don't really have a good sense of what kind of DNA repair is going to be dominant under what kind of circumstance and so forth. So it's a big unknown at the moment.
Yeah, so it kind of sounds to me like we can, in a pretty specific way, direct the cutting of the DNA, but then in many ways it seems like out of our hands how it gets joined back together. Would you say that's right? Because you talk about something in your article of this imperfect religation, so this idea that when it gets joined back together, it doesn't join back together the way we had intended for it to. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So if you use the example of He Zhongkui, for example, he was trying to make a deletion in a certain gene because a very specific deletion in that gene had been associated with resistance to HIV. But he didn't actually make that specific deletion. You know, he made other deletions in that gene, not the exact what's called Delta 32, I think it was. But he didn't replicate the exact deletion that's been found in natural populations. He created something completely different. And that's one of many reasons why people were outraged over what he'd done.
Do we have any idea about what would be an acceptable rate for some of these imperfections that you've mentioned, either imperfect religation or Cas9 cutting off target or at an unintended target?
Yeah, at this point, I don't think there's a broad consensus about it. I mean, you know, when you think about Cas9 cutting at sites that aren't the target site that you wanted it to cut, some people do kind of put that into context. Well, you know, with every cell division, you expect a certain number of errors in DNA replication, and therefore we should accept maybe a small number of off-target cuts and changes to the genome. But it's quite worrisome because it really depends on where that cut is, right? So if you have that cut, you know, in a gene that's not particularly important, maybe that's fine. But if you've disabled a tumor suppressor, then maybe you've increased the risk that the resulting child and adult from this embryo is going to develop cancer. So it's a pretty big uncertainty. I think with a lot of these sorts of safety issues, it comes down to a risk-benefit analysis and how severe is the condition that you're trying to prevent or treat versus what is the risk of causing other problems, you know, and it's a sticky issue, and I don't think there's been a broad consensus about it yet, particularly when you're talking about embryos, because now you're talking about heritable changes. These are going to affect generation after generation after generation, potentially, so it's not just one person that is at risk anymore. It's a whole lineage of people, and in a way, it's the population, right? It's a human population you're changing, so it's pretty heavy issues when it comes to risk-benefit analysis. It's kind of new territory, I think.
One other technical question here about mosaicism. So suppose an embryo is treated with gene edits. Should we expect every cell in that embryo to be edited, or will there be a mixture of edited and unedited cells? And do you have any idea what that would mean clinically for an embryo to have a mixture of edited and unedited cells?
Yeah, that's a really big concern right now. There are some reports out there, and again, because there's been so little work with human embryos, there's no real consensus about this yet, but there are some reports that suggest that if you perform the genome editing at a very early stage, at single cell stage, that you may be able to prevent or at least very sharply reduce the incidence of mosaicism. So mosaicism would be when your resulting child has different cells with different genomes, basically, because you've made the change in some cells but not others, or maybe you've made one change in some cells but a different change in other cells and so forth. So you can end up with different populations of cells within one person. And the effects of mosaicism really depend on what gene you're changing and how you've changed it, and it's hard to predict. And then it's also very hard to predict because it sort of depends on which cells were edited and which weren't and what tissues they then give rise to in the developing fetus and the baby and so forth. It's that level of unpredictability, I think, that makes mosaicism particularly concerning. And it's also something that's very hard to ever completely rule out because you can't test every cell in an embryo to find out if it's been edited because typically you destroy the cells when you test them. So you may remove a cell or two from a developing embryo and test to find out whether or not you've made your edit, but you don't know what the genome is in the other remaining cells. You can never really be sure. So that's a challenging issue. I mean, it's a lot of people just on a very practical level will say there's no way the U.S. Food and Drug Administration would feel comfortable with that kind of uncertainty because you don't know necessarily what effect that mosaicism may have then down the line.
Kind of moving past the mechanics of the technology, let's move to the other side of things. This is a philosophical question, I would say, but how do we decide what is an acceptable condition or gene to edit? And I think this is such an interesting question because, as you point out in your paper, the gene that He Zhongkui edited was intended to confer protection against HIV, but now there may be some research, as you mentioned in your article, indicating that editing this gene may actually shorten lifespan. And then the alternative side of this is if we're using CRISPR to create a new sequence of DNA, how do we decide what that sequence should look like?
Yeah, so I think the U.S. National Academies and then also the U.K. Royal Society and so forth, they came out with a report a little while ago, and I think they were saying that if you're going to try to make a heritable change to the genome, you need to recreate a DNA variant that has been very thoroughly studied and that is common enough that you have a good amount of data about what the effects of that change would be. And some people I've spoken to say that already puts most things out of reach because we really need to study them more. I mean, the CCR5 mutation that Ho-Jung Kwei tried to make is a perfect example of that. It has been studied in the context of HIV resistance, but it maybe hadn't been studied well enough in terms of other effects that it may have. And so then the study came out which suggested that people with that deletion may actually have shorter lifespans. Another issue is what population have you studied this particular DNA variant in? You know, the effects of it could vary widely depending upon what genetic background it's in. If it's in someone of Asian descent, Chinese, for example, versus someone of European descent versus someone of African descent, there could be other genes that interact with that gene variant and could have different effects there. It could have different effects in different environments. With CCR5, there's some concern that it may raise the risk of infection by some other viruses. And maybe it's okay if you're living in Europe. Maybe that's harmful if you live in China. You know, there are all sorts of unknowns. I get a little bit worked up about the Ho-Jung Kwei and the CCR5 example because I was just so shocked, actually, when I saw it. We all sort of suspected someone was going to do this. I just didn't think it would be such a flimsy medical rationale behind it. But yeah, so there was a lot that we didn't know about what he was doing, and that the same could be said for lots of other genes as well and lots of other possible edits that, you know, have been discussed. Another example might be a gene called PCSK9, which there are some variants in a gene that have been associated with lower cholesterol and improved heart health and so forth. And we know that because there's a small group of people who naturally have these DNA variants and, you know, they have excellent heart health, very low cholesterol, really great. But it's just a handful of people, and it's not quite common enough to know what are some of the other effects that may be there that just don't show up when you're only looking at a small group of people. So I think in the article that we ran recently in Nature, we highlighted Huntington's disease, which is one that is often used as an example of where you could see a rationale for deploying heritable gene editing because it is so devastating, because it is dominant and highly penetrant, meaning that if you just have one copy of Huntington's disease causing mutation, then that's almost certainly going to be sufficient to bring about this really devastating disease. That is the kind of case where I had always thought you would first see heritable gene editing deployed. It wasn't, but that's where I thought, you know, you would have people feeling more comfortable with the idea of taking such a big risk.
Another great question that keeps coming up in these interviews is, what do we call disease versus what do we call normal variation? And you mentioned a great example, members of the deaf community who might welcome the possibility of having children who are also deaf, but then also might someday receive pressure to prevent deafness if there was a CRISPR treatment that could do such a thing. So how do we distinguish between these two?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a complicated issue. You've got to really consult so many different stakeholders when it comes to all of these decisions and really think about, you know, where do you draw the line between what's sufficiently, you might say, debilitating or devastating. I think in the end, you've got to consult those who are affected by the condition now. What would you want? And you can't just consult one, right? You've got to consult a group of them, and you've got to really think about the different viewpoints that are brought forward. I mean, the deafness community is one that's often put forward as an example where some people may feel uncomfortable with the idea of, you know, not only would they not want to edit it out of their own germline, but they might not want other people to edit it out of theirs because there's a community that would erode over time if there were fewer and fewer deaf children. And, you know, I've spoken to some other advocates for people affected by genetic disease, and they've said, you know, there are many people who are concerned that the research that's done to find treatments for their particular disorder or the benefits that they receive from the government, you know, all these things may be affected if there are just fewer people with the disorder. There are all kinds of viewpoints that are out there that are sometimes not super intuitive, I think, if you don't have direct experience with a given disorder. And it's really important to go out and sample those different viewpoints. Different regions of the world will have different takes on this issue as well. They'll have different religious viewpoints of it. They'll have different social viewpoints of it. Areas where fertility and the ability to have your own genetically related child is very, very important. That may drive more of a push for technology like this as opposed to places where that is not so important and maybe other options for having a child are more acceptable. You know, it's all kinds of different considerations. So I think it's widely understood that the discussion needs to be broader than it is currently. That right now you really have a lot of people from the United States and Europe, for example, weighing in on this issue. But I do think there is recognition that, and there are some efforts to pull in, you know, other populations around the world, not just academics, but also people who represent those who are directly affected by genetic disease and so on.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much, Heidi, for joining us today and talking about your paper. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Heidi Ledford. I encourage our audience to check out her article. It's available online in Nature as a news feature. It was published June 19th. Again, the title of the article is CRISPR Babies, When Will the World Be Ready? Thank you, Heidi.
Oh, thank you so much.
This is Stacey Clardy. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting article on microstructural white matter changes preceding white matter hyperintensities in migraine, and another article on the effect of polygenic load on striatal dopaminergic deterioration in Parkinson's disease. Please take a look at these and other articles this week. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week. The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.